Don Cheadle seems like the kind of guy who I wouldn't want to hang around with under any circumstances ever. He's so f***ing whack. Honestly.
Ashton Kutcher needs to get hit by a bus ASAP.
I hate Courtney Cox. I hate her. That's sweet.
If I said it once, I've said it 100 times. Andy Garcia.
Celebrities reading their own mean tweets from late night's Jimmy Kimmel show. Tweets and comments can get pretty nasty in the digital world, and that nastiness can even come in the form of threats. Now the Supreme Court is going to decide whether those threats are free speech or a criminal act. And we're going to talk about that later on in the show. But first, we're going to look at two decisions announced this morning by the court. In a unanimous ruling, the court said police must always have a warrant to search mobile phones when arresting someone. In his opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, "Modern cell phones aren't a technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life." Jess Braven covers the court for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so give us the details in this case. What did the court say?
Well, this is a very unequivocal and one could even say bold decision, completely rejecting the law enforcement arguments that searching the contents of a cell phone should not require a warrant when the cell phone is seized from someone whom they've arrested. The police had argued that under a current exception to the warrant requirement, which allows police to go through the pockets of people they arrest and leaf through, say, an address book or some photographs or a crumpled cigarette package, to cite a particular case from the past, that they don't need a warrant to look through those things, and there's really no legal distinction between a cell phone that might be in someone's pocket or within reach when he or she is arrested, and they should be able to look through that just the same. The court absolutely rejected that, and the quote you read from the Chief Justice indicates that the justices saw a cell phone not as just a somewhat improved address book, but rather as a device unlike anything else that that had been contemplated. So this is a very significant decision, not only because of the protection it gives to cell phones that people might be carrying when they are arrested, but also in the general tenor, the way that it's almost as if the court is saying, we get it. We understand what life in the early 21st century is. We are fully attuned to the fact that the digital world is not just a slightly modified form of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so surprising to you that this was a unanimous decision?
It was not surprising that it was unanimous. The court was clearly at oral argument very skeptical of the position taken by the government in the two cases here. One case involved a federal crime in Boston. The other was a California state court decision. The justices were quite skeptical of the police position in both cases, so it was not necessarily a surprise. But what is a little bit of a surprise is how unequivocal the language is and how bright the line the court draws between things like maybe a billfold or a matchbook that might be in someone's pocket when they're arrested on Hollywood Boulevard in 1958, and an iPhone or some other device today, which can connect to the cloud and can download thousands of addresses, can include videos. He just goes again and again, having different examples of why a digital is different.
Interesting. And I wonder if this would have any repercussions at all in terms of some journalists fight against having to turn over some of their material that they have perhaps on their electronic devices, because I assume this doesn't just apply to telephones.
Well, what this deals with, though, however, is a particular type of situation, which is when police arrest somebody, they are currently allowed to go through their pockets or go through things that are within reach of them. And although the court has never fully explained why they don't need a warrant to do that, the precedents have really identified two principal rationales. One is to protect the police from injury if the suspect is carrying a weapon. So that's one reason. They're looking for weapons that might be there. The second is to prevent destruction of evidence. They want to safely isolate the evidence from the suspect so it doesn't disappear before they get to trial. Those are the two rationales. The court never quite explained why that allows an officer to, say, go through an address book or a diary that they find on someone, because those don't seem to really indicate danger or risk of losing evidence. But they never fully explained that. They just said that's okay. And that was what the law enforcement authorities had been relying on. But here, though, they say the two rationales, officer safety and preservation of evidence, simply don't apply to the contents of the cell phone. Now, it's different when we're talking about the physical object. Police can look at that to make sure there's not a razor blade hidden in it or that kind of thing. And as always, in anything involving the warrant requirement, there is what's called the exigent circumstances exception. In other words, if there's some incredible emergency where you simply can't wait to go to a judge and get a search warrant, then yes, they can look through it. And that's a response to the hypothetical situations that the government put forward as to why police can't wait for a warrant. Maybe the cell phone is being used to trigger an explosive somewhere or something like that. And the court really discounted those and said those seem very, very speculative. And if you ever run into a situation like that, then, do it, search without a warrant, and then when it's challenged in court, assert that you had exigent circumstances that required you to do it. You couldn't wait.
Yeah. Well, really quickly, though, it seems interesting that when it comes down to issues of privacy, they issued a very different decision very recently when they said that police could take a DNA sample of someone without a warrant. And we only have 30 seconds.
They could. That was a 5-4 decision, and it shows how it's tough for them to grapple with these kinds of advancing technologies. Maybe more significant is a couple of years ago, they ruled unanimously that police needed a warrant, or rather that it was a search that should require a warrant when police put a GPS tracker on a suspect's car.
All right. Jess Braven, covering the Supreme Court for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
In another high court decision handed down today, TV networks won a huge victory over a company called Aereo. Aereo provided a subscription service that lets you watch or record live network television shows using a PC or a cell phone. But the court's 6-3 decision will effectively shut Aereo down. Jonathan Handel has been closely watching the case. He's an entertainment lawyer and a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi.
Good afternoon, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So tell us about the arguments on both sides.
Sure. The key thing in understanding Aereo's argument is the way the system works, which in brief is that if you want to watch a program, there's an individual antenna. They have thousands of dime-sized antennas in their server farm. So there's an individual antenna that's assigned to you. That antenna streams to the hard drive in a section of the hard drive reserved for you. And then you watch it from the hard drive with a 7-second delay, even if you're watching live. So you're not even watching directly from the antenna. Now, Aereo said, look, this is just like a remote storage DVR, remote storage digital video recorder, where the recording capability is in the central office. And those were ruled legal by the Second Circuit, the Court of Appeals that covers the New York area, for example. And that's why Aereo started in New York, in fact. They hung their hat on that and said, look, this is what we're doing. We're a remote storage DVR type system. But, of course, since they allow you to watch essentially live television, broadcast TV, any channel, you choose what you want, Aereo also looks an awful lot like a cable system. And that was the argument that the broadcasters were making. They were saying that Aereo was essentially equivalent to a cable system. It was retransmitting content publicly, they said, without a license. Aereo said, we're not doing anything publicly. The retransmissions are private because they're one-to-one, and we're not even the ones volitionally doing the retransmission. Nothing happens with our system until the user clicks on something. And that's a distinction that was held to make a big difference as far back as 1984 when the court upheld VCRs in the Betamax case.
Right. So basically, the government, which was on the side of the broadcasters, and the broadcasters were saying, in its essence, their Aereo is stealing content because they're not paying to re-air this content.
Right. And of course, the irony is that this is content that's available over the air for free to anyone who wants to put up an antenna. And
so what is the difference between Aereo and an antenna, regular old antenna?
Well, the difference in the court's mind was that if a consumer goes out and buys an antenna and puts an antenna on their roof or behind the TV set, that's the consumer buying equipment and doing something themselves. Whereas here, it's an outside company, Aereo, that is providing a service and providing equipment. So the court found that to be, and again, as you said, it's a 6-3 decision with a very vociferous dissent. But the court found that to be critical, a critical difference.
Now, Aereo has called the ruling a massive setback for the American consumer. What do you think about that?
You know, that's a very, very hard call. On the one hand, this is likely to retard and delay development of technological innovations. The court decision, which sort of takes the language of copyright law and says, well, we're going to look at this language, but really we're going to step back and say, this thing looks like a cable system, quacks like a cable system, walks like a duck, and therefore we're going to decide in this way. That makes it very hard for other technology companies to know what's permitted and what's not, which is exactly a point that the dissent makes. But on the other hand, you know, you see people like the Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, weighing in and saying, look, if money doesn't flow through the ecosystem here from people like Aereo, and they weren't paying a license fee to the broadcasters, then ultimately the people that create content won't get compensated appropriately, and the whole system falls apart.
Well, you know, a lot of people were looking at this as a test for the whole system and predicting that if the court had sided with Aereo, it would be the end of the system as we know it, because it would have fundamentally reordered how we get our or at least paved the way for how we get our broadcast television. Do you think that that was in the cards with that, in that if it's not Aereo today, it might be another company tomorrow?
Well, I think that's kind of a question mark. I mean, you know, the studios sued to block the VCR back in 84, as I alluded to, and they said that the VCR was going to destroy content creation. In fact, the opposite happened. The VCR saved the movie industry, the home video did, and was a cash cow for many years and continues to be a really important source of revenue. So, you know, there's a lot of skepticism to be had. The idea that the broadcaster said, well, we'll yank our signals off the air and make them go cable only if the court rules in favor of Aereo, you know, that spectrum space is a really valuable monopoly, and the likelihood that they really would have done that and given up spectrum seems dubious. What is happening now is that the broadcasters are starting to develop their own systems of this sort, but there's a key difference. Even though the signals are available free over the air if you put up an antenna, if you want to get them on your cell phone, you're going to have to be a paying subscriber to a cable or satellite system. That's called TV Everywhere, and they're trying to essentially shift the revenue base from advertising, as advertising stalls and even declines, to retransmission fees that are paid by the system owners.
Yeah. Well, still, there are an increasing number of people who are cord cutters who are saying, well, I don't want to pay my cable bill if I can get TV in other ways. And are the cable companies themselves worried about this and how this decision might play out?
Well, I think the cable companies are celebrating a victory here. It's interesting that they weren't actually plaintiffs. They really were the sort of the silent partners or silent elephants in the room, as the case may be. Because if Aereo had won, you know, Aereo's price point is $8 to $12 a month. They were essentially starting to build a cable system from the ground up with broadcast, and they already had Bloomberg cable news on their system. That would have driven a trend ultimately towards unbundling of cable systems and being able to pay for the channels that you want and not for the ones that you don't, and hopefully not having to pay, you know, $100 a month for your service. This decision by the Supreme Court is going to slow that process and will cost consumers more money and guarantee more profits to the cable systems.
Jonathan Handel is an entertainment attorney, and he works for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, more legal news. A dog trainer and Marine Corps veteran is on the government's no-fly list. We're going to find out why, or try to. A federal judge just ruled that the no-fly list is unconstitutional. That story coming up on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In Oregon, a federal judge has decided that rules for the government's no-fly list are unconstitutional. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Anna Brown said that international travel is not a mere convenience or luxury. It's a necessary aspect of liberties sacred to members of a free society. The ACLU brought the case on behalf of 13 plaintiffs. One of them is Abe Mashal. He's a dog trainer and a U.S. Marine Corps veteran from Chicago. He wrote a book. It's called No Spy, No Fly, about his experience. Welcome.
Hello, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. So why were you one of the plaintiffs involved in this case?
Well, I found out the hard way I was on the no-fly list. I basically went to the airport back in April of 2010, trying to fly out to Washington State to train a dog out there. And when I got to the airport, I was surrounded by TSA agents and Chicago police and told that I was on the no-fly list, and the FBI was on their way to the building to speak with me.
And what did they say to you?
Well, it was a big shock, obviously. They asked me to go in back to answer some questions. I went in back, and they just asked me some random questions about my nationality. And then once they found out that I was half Arab, half Islamic descent background, asked me some more questions. The interview lasted about 15 minutes, and then he told me I was free to go. And I told the agent, I said, well, wait a minute, man, I got a question for you. And he says, okay. And I said, well, how did I get on this list and how do I get off of it? And he says, even if I knew, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But he told me to go to the DHS website and fill out their redress form and then put basically as you saying I was denied boarding, you know, why, and I shouldn't have been. And I filled out that form. And later that day, I got a call from two additional FBI agents who came to my residence and questioned me for over an hour. And they actually had a do not fly question and answer sheet where they went through and talked about my military background, you know, who's my bank accounts with, who's my emails with. It was a very invasive interview. And, you know, shortly after that, you fast forward a couple months till June of 2010, they gave me a call telling me they had great news for me, the FBI, and they would like to meet with me. And to make a long story short, I met with them, and they offered me a way off the no-fly list by becoming an informant for them. And at that point, I told them I'd like to speak with an attorney. And they told me to leave the interview, and that's how I got involved with the lawsuit. I contacted the ACLU, told them the story, and that's how I got involved with the lawsuit.
An informant, and what were you asked to do, or didn't I get that far?
Well, they told me to go. They would like for me to go undercover at various mosques, find out about certain people, and they would be paying me under the table. I wouldn't be claiming this money, and I couldn't even tell my wife I was doing this. It was something out of a movie. It was crazy.
And are you a practicing Muslim?
I am, but I don't attend any mosque or anything like that. So that's why I was kind of a little bit odd that they wanted me to act like James Bond and do some work for them.
Yeah, yeah. So you never found out why you were put on the list?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what
you said. You never found out why you were put on the list?
No, I never did. There's never been any official reason, and there was never any official reason when they took me off either, because I actually attempted to fly for the first time last year with my lawyer from the ACLU. And I was able to fly without any trouble. I was even able to print my boarding pass from the house. So the weirdest thing is you go from the no-fly list, and you'd think, okay, if they took me off of it, they'd put me on maybe a high screening list where I'd be pulled for additional security. But I wasn't even – that didn't even happen. It appears that I went from the no-fly list to absolutely no list.
All right. So tell us a bit about the ruling that came down yesterday and what it means for people on the no-fly list.
Well, the ruling is an excellent ruling, in my opinion. We've been waiting a very long time for this ruling. It basically states that the no-fly list is unconstitutional, that we do have a right to travel by air, and, you know, it's not just some privilege that we have, and that the government cannot put you on these lists without telling you first and telling you the reasons why they put you on this list and then allowing you to contest those reasons. So these are really good things because, in my opinion, that was the biggest problem with the list is they take you on and off. You don't even know what's going on behind the scenes. You have no reason why you were put on or taken off, and you're just kind of left in the dark. It doesn't sound very American. So I'm really glad the judge has realized the hardships and harassment the plaintiff has been through, including myself, and she's making them change all that. So that's really good. So it doesn't happen to anybody in the future.
And part of it is no one knows exactly how many people are on the list, right?
Right. Nobody knows. I mean, they say 20,000, and then out of that, 500 of them are Americans. But, I mean, how would you know if they're not telling anybody? The only ones that would know would be the people adding and taking people off the list. So nobody would know that answer to that.
All right. So this ruling, I guess, does it go into effect, or is it stayed pending an appeal by the government?
Well, they say it's pending appeal, but from what I've heard from several different attorneys at the ACLU, that the judge's ruling was so strong that they do not feel like the government is going to even attempt to appeal this, which would surprise me, because they've appealed everything the entire time, which is why it's taken 4 years. They've just tried to stall the case as much as they can. They really don't want to deal with it, it seems like. But hopefully they don't appeal it, and then it goes into effect right away.
And I'm just wondering, you were in the Marine Corps, right?
Yes.
And so you did serve in the government. What was your reaction to being on the other side, if you will, in this?
Well, I was, a few different emotions. You know, you're frustrated, you get angry, and it's a little bit embarrassing at the same time. Because during one of the interviews, the FBI actually asked me about my military experience in the Marine Corps. And they said, well, were you trained with explosives? And I said, no, I wasn't. But, you know, when you ask a Marine, it's like, I served for this country, so why are you asking me like I learned things to do things against this country? It was just really strange. And, you know, they shouldn't do that to people, especially people they know they shouldn't be messing with for no apparent reason anyway. So I'm really glad with the decision that the judge has made.
Right, right. So is there any thought that you might take any further action, sue the government or anything like
well,
that?
Well, I think, you know, I'm part of this lawsuit, and I just want to see my way completely through it. This seems to be the final chapter, and it's exactly where we want to be. You know, there's been a lot of hardships in a lot of different areas, even financially for my businesses that I run, a personal level and everything else. So we'll see when we get to those points as well. But right now we're just happy that things are going to hopefully change.
Yeah, right. And so your theory for why you were put on the list is because of your background and because you're a practicing Muslim. Is that why you think
well,
you're Muslim?
Yeah, you know, there's really, there's several other plaintiffs on the lawsuit with me that have military backgrounds and they're Muslim, and they were offered informant positions to come off of the no-fly list. So my personal feelings on this has always been that they really use this list as leverage to make you do things for them. And everything I've seen over the years kind of aims towards that, but there's really no way of knowing, and I have no idea why they would have done it to me. But my personal thoughts on that is that they use it as a form of leverage.
All right, Abe Mashal, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
That's Abe Mashal. He's a dog trainer and a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. He spoke to us from Chicago, and he's written a book about his experience. It's called No Spy, No Fly. Well, what do you think? Was this a good decision, or does it make sense that we give up some civil liberties in order for the government to try to keep us safe? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, for most of us, time is right now. The present is all important, and so we are going to take some time to put our lives in a little perspective by appreciating some of the world's oldest living things, organisms that are thousands of years old. That story coming up after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The oldest living human has been on Earth for about 116 years. A Japanese woman was born the same year that the U.S. declared war on Spain, the year Pepsi-Cola hit the market, the year Marie Curie announced her discovery of radium, 1898. Another world for sure. But get this, the oldest living thing in the world is more than 5,000 times that age. 600,000-year-old bacteria discovered in the permafrost of Siberia. From that bacteria to California's giant sequoias to ancient eucalyptus trees in Australia, Rachel Sussman has spent the better part of the last decade seeking out the oldest living things in the world. And the results of her adventures are compiled in her new photography book. It's called The Oldest Living Things in the World. And she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. It's a big, heavy coffee table book full of amazing photographs. And you describe at the very beginning of the book, also some great essays to go along with those photos, that the kernel of this idea began in Japan when you went there and you were there for some other purpose. And there you were in the beautiful city of Kyoto, full of the temples and the cherry trees. And then you see a Starbucks and a Kinko's.
Yeah.
You think, what's going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, I went on this trip to Japan not really knowing what I was looking for, but, you know, keeping my eyes open, looking to create some new artwork, certainly. And I'd been photographing a lot of landscapes dealing with the relationship between humanity and nature. And I was in Kyoto and thinking, this isn't quite what I thought it was going to be, to the point where I was so uncomfortable. I thought I might go home.
And just give up on Kyoto and Japan?
It was something, it's one of those feelings that was rare for me, but something was telling me I needed to do something different. But I did not go home. Instead, I took some advice that a couple of different people had mentioned to me. They said, if you're interested in nature, you have to go visit the 7,000-year-old tree. And it turns out this tree lives on a remote island called Yakushima. It's off the southernmost point of Kyushu. It's a 3 or 4 hour ferry ride just to get there. Then once you land on the island, it's a 2-day hike to visit this tree. So it was no small commitment.
And then when you saw it, did that just blow your mind?
It did blow my mind. I wish I could tell you that I had an epiphany standing there right at that moment and got the idea for the project, but creativity is often not that simple. And over a year later, I was telling some friends about this amazing adventure that I'd had, and that was my light bulb moment, thinking about art and science and their intersection. And I ran home and got started on the project that very night.
That very night. And you thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to document all the oldest living things on Earth?
Well, yeah. So the plan was to look at organisms that were 2,000 years old and older. And the reason for that was to think about the idea of year zero, to put into context our human timekeeping, that it's really so shallow. You know, we're thinking 5 minutes ago, 5 minutes from now. Why is it even 2014 right now? What does that mean? And so this was a way to contextualize this deeper time scale and also to work directly with scientists who had done the research on these individual organisms, as well as bring both the conceptual art of the project as a whole, along with the photographs, which are art objects in and of themselves. So to blend all of these things together.
Mm-hmm. And you found a lot of them, a lot of these objects that you photographed, these living things, I should say. Because you say you will not photograph something that's dead, although
that's
you did
right.
make one exception, which we can talk about later. And you found several of them right here in Southern California, or in California, I should say.
Well, a lot in Southern California, too. Yes, it was remarkable, actually, to find that there are so many in California. You have certainly the better known ones like the giant sequoias and the bristlecone pines.
And then there's one in, not a bristlecone, but a tree in Riverside that is, what, 13,000
yes,
years
old.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah. So that's an example of something growing clonally. But also, I just love that it's growing in Riverside.
Yeah.
And this was a favorite of mine as well, because the scientists actually tracked me down and said, hey, we have this really amazing discovery. Why isn't it in your project? I said, oh, I didn't know about it, but I'll be right there. So,
Is it in some abandoned housing development? Or
it might as well be. It's actually on a piece of land that is adjacent to some off-road vehicle track. And then there's a cement factory on one side and a shipping container factory on the other. And it's sort of just this relic of an ecosystem that no longer exists. But it's perched in such a manner that I think it's just stayed out of harm's way.
Well, as I said earlier, you did make an exception on the living rule for your book, and that is the Senator tree in Florida, which was living until very recently. Tell us a story about this tree and how it died.
Sure. So the senator tree was 3,500 years old. It's a bald cypress tree living in Orlando. And it was actually the original tourist attraction. So I say BD before Disney. and I first visited it back in 2007. And I made some photographs of it. But I just returned from this 2-month trip where I'd been to Africa and was having these wild adventures. And then I went to Orlando and I was a little nonchalant about it, I have to admit. And I came away from that visit feeling like the photographs just didn't really capture the essence of this tree. Like, it just wasn't, I wasn't focused. The camera wasn't focused. Something just wasn't right. And I thought, you know what? I'll just come back. It's so easy to go to Orlando. It couldn't be easier. So I have all these other places to go, and I put it on the back burner. And what happened was a few years later, it was no longer there. So you think something has been alive for 3,500 years, it's going to be alive for 3,505. But longevity is not the same as immortality. The tree was hollow in the center. And this is something that happens with older trees often. It turned out that some kids had snuck into the park at night to do meth inside the tree. And we later knew this because they posted about it on Facebook. And
what a metaphor for the way we're living right now.
Absolutely. Ugh. Absolutely. And that was a particularly poignant moment for me. And it reminded me, it was so jarring, it reminded me not to take these things for granted.
Well, that brings us to the point where you really talk about the human effects on these organisms and how these ones that you've been able to photograph have been able to survive all sorts of depredations visited upon them by us. And how is it that some of these organisms have been able to survive for so long, given everything that we've done to the planet?
It's a really interesting question and a complex one. I mean, one thing to think about, as I started to gather all of these organisms together, I was noticing there's some similarities in that a lot of them tend to live in very extreme environments. So they're adapted to things like very cold temperatures, very hot temperatures, high elevations, low nutrient availability. But the thing to keep in mind is they're uniquely adapted to these environments. And this is where climate change becomes such a pressing issue. They've evolved to live in these climates, but the climate is changing so rapidly now, most of them are in danger.
Including the bristlecone.
Certainly. The bristlecone, absolutely. They have a number of issues. Increased temperature has created faster growth rates, which is a problem because their survival strategy is to grow incredibly slowly. And they're growing faster now than they have in the past 3,700 years. So this is just one example of one organism that's directly affected by human-made climate change.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Rachel Sussman. She's the author of the book, The Oldest Living Things in the World. So you travel from the United States and go all around the world. You go to Greenland, you go to Antarctica, you go to Crete. And that's where you have a personal experience that I think the reason I'm bringing it up is because I think that this book also tries to tackle what it means to be confronted with something that is so old when you're dealing with a crisis in your own personal life. And so you're with your boyfriend and you get in an argument and you realize this is the end of the relationship and you come up across this old olive tree. And I wonder if you could talk about that and how it figured into how you're feeling at the moment.
In order to connect with these deeper timescales, we have to connect with who we are as people, as individuals. And that moment, you know, being in Crete and having this, you know, pretty terrible argument, it really made me stop and think about what that means. It's something that I was saying a lot. Oh, yeah, we have, you know, like, oh, I'm hungry. But I'm standing next to this thing, this tree that's been there for 3,000 years. What does that mean? And I don't mean to diminish the experience that we have as humans, because it's really all of these things are important. They're, you know, these are moments in our lives that become this compendium of who we are, just the same way that it is for the organisms themselves. It's layer upon layer of time and experience that you have. And so it was certainly difficult, and you know, and it certainly will always color that experience of visiting that tree for me.
Yeah, and so you're there standing there, and the tree, there's some olives on the ground, I guess, and there are olive branches, obviously that's significant,
yes.
The olive branch.
Yeah.
And so
you have to throw a little poetry in there, yeah. Too.
Did it comfort you in any way to think, okay, I'm in this moment right now of crisis, and yet here is this tree that's been here for thousands of years. Maybe my problems aren't so big.
Yeah, you know, I think there is something of that. You live through these things, you do heal, and by communing, if you will, with these ancient organisms, you understand, I think, that time is much longer than this moment, and staying connected to something larger, I do find very comforting.
Was there one object that you could say really encapsulated your goal and what you wanted to get out of this project?
I have to say one of my favorites is the moss living in Antarctica. So it's 5,500 years old. It lives on Elephant Island, which is right off the Antarctic Peninsula, and also happens to be where the Shackleton expedition was marooned, mm-hmm. right around the corner from where this moss lives. And it was all of the layers of that. It was incredibly difficult to get there, as you can imagine. It took quite a lot of research to track down the published paper, then to track down the researchers, then to get access to get on a ship going to the right place in Antarctica. Antarctica is enormous. We tend to forget that. And then just to be in this kind of unimaginable landscape. It was truly humbling and mind-blowing. And thinking about it, not just in terms of this moss that's persevered in this environment, but also the Shackleton crew, which they survived there in Antarctica for 2 years, basically coming to their own rescue on this rowboat across the Drake Passage. It's kind of unfathomable.
And it's also unfathomable a little bit that moss could survive there. Mm-hmm. You don't think,
yes,
of moss as being part of this icy world.
Exactly. And certainly when you see the coast of Antarctica from a distance, it just looks white. And then you get closer in and you see that there's so much more going on. And not just mosses. There's also lichens. and of course, the wildlife. It's quite noisy there. That was something I hadn't really prepared for. The penguins and seals make quite a lot of noise as compared to somewhere like Greenland, where I've never heard such quiet in my life.
You know, we keep hearing these really dire stories about global warming and how our natural world is being destroyed. But what you're describing is really a story of hope. It's a story of perseverance and optimism in a weird way. And mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of negative effects are happening on these individuals, these organisms that you visited and photographed. But did you come away from this feeling hopeful? About the future of the environment in some way?
Yes. I mean, I am hopeful. I think you're right. I wouldn't have made work like this if I wasn't hopeful. And my goal is to allow people to connect with this environmental message in a way that doesn't feel as abstract as, well, the CO2 level is now more than 400 parts per million. It just doesn't register. It doesn't feel like there's anything you can do about it. It feels too big. But looking at these organisms, I'm hoping that there's some way that people will can forge a more personal connection with them. And I look at them as symbols and something that both transcend the things that divide us. They live on every continent. They live in all sorts of different kinds of ecosystems. And by protecting them, I think there's a wonderful cascading effect of positive change that can come about. So I do hope that the book can engage in that way.
Well, Rachel Sussman, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Rachel Sussman's new book, it's a gorgeous photography book. It's called The Oldest Living Things in the World. Well, we're going to pull ourselves out of the deep past and go to the future in about 15 minutes with Barbara Bogave, who is sitting in for Warren Olney. Hi there.
Well, hello. And in the future, we will be talking on To the Point about something you talked about, Aereo, the ruling. We're talking to an editor of Gizmodo who says Silicon Valley is not happy. And also, we're talking to someone who represents artists and producers who says, great, it's protecting their copyright and their income. Mm-hmm. So that's the conversation. And we'll talk about the role of campaign financing in this recent election in Mississippi.
Oh, where Thad Cochran eked it out.
There you go. The stunner.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to that. That's at 1 o'clock. Warren Olney, Barbara Bogay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sitting in for Warren Olney. Coming up on this program, speaking of the court, the Supreme Court's going to decide next term whether or not you can make death threats online. And whether that's different than making verbal threats. And we're going to look at what may be the silliest app on the market right now. We're going to talk about that. All the Internet Roundup news coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The best place to find some of the worst human discourse is, of course, online in the comments sections. You probably know that a simple YouTube video of someone's dog or something can lead to name-calling, accusation hurling, just all kinds of ugliness. In fact, death threats have become so common online, they've almost lost their meaning. Well, now the U.S. Supreme Court says it'll decide whether death threats should be taken literally, or if telling someone you want to kill them on Facebook is just a form of free speech. Joining us now to talk about this and other internet-related news are the two guys behind the WNYC podcast, TLDR, and that stands for Too Long, Didn't Read, in internet parlance. PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman, welcome.
Hi.
Well, let's start, Alex, with this death threat story. It's a case involving a Pennsylvania guy who made some pretty gross statements online. Tell us about that.
Well, it's about a guy named Anthony Alanis, and he broke up with his wife, and he began making a series of really, really dark, dark threats on Facebook. And they're not ambiguous at all. He talks about shooting up schools. He has one that where he says he's explicitly not making a death threat because a death threat is against the law. But if he were making a death threat, it would sound like this, and then goes on to detail all of the ways that he sort of wants to hurt his ex-wife. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison, but the Supreme Court is now hearing the case. Essentially, the defense's argument is that a death threat is only a death threat when you ignore the context. And the context of this is that he had no serious intention. It should be obvious to those who were paying attention, who knew him, that he had no intention of actually hurting his wife, and he was just exercising his right to free speech.
This is PJ jumping in. It just sort of makes you realize how strange it is that we've all decided as a society that we're okay with a discourse where people routinely tell each other that they're going to kill each other. And if it's on the internet, we've decided it's okay and it doesn't matter. Like, if we're going to have a broader conversation about whether that is speech we want to protect, it actually doesn't seem that hard to imagine a future where the idea that we had this historical period where we were all saying, I'm going to kill you, was a blip, and that we decided we didn't want that, and that we don't particularly miss it because there's not a ton of good in it, you know?
Mm. Well, I'm surprised you guys are coming down on the side of the law on this one.
I hedge a little bit on this because there are a lot of kids who have the same access to the internet as adults, but don't necessarily have the same ability to exercise great judgment, and will make very cavalier, somewhat joking statements in which they are going to commit some sort of violent act. A lot of times they're quoting from movies. A lot of times they're just goofing around with their friends. And those people end up getting prosecuted. Those people who are 16 or older generally end up getting prosecuted as adults and end up facing, you know, a decade plus of jail time.
Yeah, actually, there was that story, was it like 6 months ago, about a teenager, I think in Amsterdam, who jokingly tweeted that she wanted to kill President Obama. And it just, that tweet went viral, and the Secret Service contacted her in her country. And it felt like a thing where no one looking at it thought that a 16-year-old girl was going to hop on a plane and make an attempt on the American president's life. But because in this one instance, we treat death threats so seriously, that everybody was overreacting in this way that everybody watching it could see.
And in that way, this discussion is sort of making a compelling argument that, yes, death threats are contextual and should be thought of in the context in which they're being said. But it just seems to me that there are so few circumstances in which a death threat feels like a joke and they should probably be taken pretty seriously.
Wait, so which side of the street? I think I've...
Which side are you on, you guys? Now I'm very confused. However, you know, what's interesting here is that this idea of what is free speech and what is indeed a threat, you know, yelling fire in a crowded movie theater has been around for many, 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 many years. But it's the internet aspect of this that is the new aspect, obviously, and something that maybe is the deciding factor in why the Supreme Court took it up.
Right. I think so. I think because what happens is the internet puts people in front of audiences that they don't necessarily realize they're in front of. Someone says something and maybe the people that they mean that message for are going to understand it. But if that's amplified outside of their social circle, you can't necessarily expect law enforcement to know, you know, that guy, he makes a lot of joking death threats, but he would never really do anything.
There's also this is Alex, by the way. There's also the concept of internet disinhibition syndrome, which is this idea mm-hmm. that people behave in a way on the internet that they never would otherwise, because it just gives you it like masks your interaction with people just enough that it allows you to sort of behave like a much greater buffoon than you would in a normal circumstance.
Okay, that gives a perfect opportunity to go to our next topic, speaking of buffoonery, and that is this new app. It's the Yo app. It's a messaging app that allows people to text the word yo to each other, and that's it. And it what's incredible to me is that we're A, talking about it, but B, that it made the top 10 most downloaded, I guess that's not incredible, in the Apple Store, and raised $1 million in investment money. So what's going on here?
There's two perspectives on this. One is that this is a perfect example of like an Emperor's New Clothes tech story. It's a useless app that received a lot of money and then received a lot of hype because it received a lot of money, and then that hype got it attention, and so it sort of was a dumb dream that justified itself, and this is insipid nonsense that no one should ever use. I think the other perspective is that really whatever message service you design, what you're really trying to do is get a lot of people on it. Like one example of this is there's a texting program called WhatsApp that you can use to text internationally.
Yeah.
And initially that's just what people are using it for, but now it's become used as a thing where people share content, like a social network, and it's actually unofficially one of the biggest social networks. People didn't mean to design it that way, but it sort of evolved that way. And once you have enough people on board, the initial reason that they showed up doesn't really matter.
Well, so what else could you do with this Yo app besides send Yo to someone?
Yo? Not much.
Well, but they could change it. I mean, they could change it so you can send pictures. They could change it so you can send, what would you say besides Yo? Hey?
Yeah.
Well, why can't you just do that on your regular instant messaging platform?
I think it's a case of an app that was designed to create buzz in order to then, like PJ said, justify its existence. It seems like a one-note joke that is a bit of a commentary on the way that we use social media. I mean, I think that 90% of people use social media as like an echolocator kind of. They're just shouting, I'm here, now I'm here, now I'm doing this, now I'm alive, I'm still alive. And saying yo is really the most pure distillation of how people use social media.
But if it were just an app that just said, I'm still alive, I would be 100% on board with it. Like, that would be such a better app.
Okay, here's another app. And this one I think is probably more useful for all of us. And it's called Timesify. And it basically camouflages your embarrassing websites by making it look like you're reading the New York Times. I love this.
Oh, it is the greatest thing in the world. I mean, particularly we're public radio employees, which means that everyone is very smart and sophisticated and highbrow. And the ability to just take
stupid.
Or we pretend to be.
I feel like you're trying some wish fulfillment here.
Well, I know
you're
Timesifying
this conversation.
Yeah, so you can take the dumb website that you actually read at work instead of the websites you should be reading at work, and it just sort of masks them. And it actually really does work kind of perfectly. There's such a like visual grammar to the Times that I think people don't notice that you're on the message board for the one band that you like. And
it feels like a high-tech version of stuffing a Mad Magazine in your textbook, which is something I definitely did when I was in high school.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman, producers for NPR's On the Media, and they host the podcast TLDR. Julie Myers is here. Hi there.
I've got the feedback.
You
but
have the feedback.
First, Madeline.
Yes.
I've been trying to figure out how to Timesify our feedback segment.
Yes.
How about this? This is Press Play. I'm Lakshmi Singh. Does that feel higher brow?
No, it does
no?
not. You do not sound like Lakshmi
Was
Singh.
Was that also the worst Lakshmi Singh you've ever
much.
Heard? Lakshmi, I'm coming for you.
What is your Mad Magazine, digital Mad Magazine?
Well, the thing is you have to have shame in order to want to use the Times
and
of
you
Five
have
thing.
No shame, clearly.
No, you see me looking up adoptable puppies in the afternoon when I just can't think anymore. I don't try to hide that. Also, how would they even do that? It would be like the Times font and then pictures of puppies like rolling around in the grass. I don't think it would work. I'd be busted.
What are those puppies doing in Syria?
I think that I would be busted, Madeline. Okay, so another item from our internet roundup, whether death threats on Facebook should be protected speech. Well, Raphael Guillen shared his story on our Facebook page. His girlfriend's ex-husband frequently sent him threats on Facebook. Facebook and the authorities said they couldn't do anything about it, and it caused so much stress in the relationship that they ended up breaking up. So there can be some real-life consequences for this stuff. Hugh Dismook says, sorry, I probably butchered that, says he used to be like, bring on the mean, he'd attack right back. But the vitriol online has gotten so thick and pervasive that attacking back has just become exhausting. Mm. He can't do it anymore. And Margarita Hagatha Moore left us a comment too on Facebook. She says that when you get threatening comments from people you actually know, and you know that they're really angry, it's kind of hard to chalk up the whole thing to artistic expression. It can get really creepy.
All right. That seemed to have struck a nerve, that topic.
It did.
And
it sure did.
And that and plus the other Supreme Court news also people are talking about. If you want to weigh in on that, you are more than welcome. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a message on our Facebook page, please. No threats. KCRW's Press Play or Twitter at KCRW Press Play and also voicemail 1-844 Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand on Twitter as well. And Barbara Bogave hosting To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand and I'll see you tomorrow.